You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you tuned in today. This hour, the new coronavirus surge abroad and whether the U.S. should be doing more to help. If you want to know how catastrophic things truly are in India, read the first paragraph of Jeffrey Gettleman's dispatch from New Delhi to the New York Times. Crematories are so full of bodies, it's as if a war just happened. Fires burn around the clock. Many places are holding mass cremations. Here's Gettleman last week on the Daily podcast.
I had a friend call me the other night late, and he had a friend who was very sick with coronavirus, a young guy, maybe in his 30s. And my friend was trying to find a hospital for him to go to. He tried every contact he had. He called around himself, and they couldn't find a space for this guy. And he ended up dying in the back of an ambulance because no hospital would take him.
India is counting new virus cases every day in the hundreds of thousands. Last week, they hit a new single daily record of nearly 353,000 cases, and that is believed to be an undercount. Other countries like Brazil and France and Russia have high confirmed case counts, too. So today, we're examining the reason some countries are not seeing declines in transmission the way the United States is, and how much of that has to do with vaccine geopolitics. The Biden administration recently announced it would share its AstraZeneca vaccines with other countries, but that decision is coming late for some of these other countries. As our guests join us, I'd like you to think about this. Should the United States have been more generous with its vaccine stocks in the beginning? Should we be sharing more now? What do you want to know about how some countries got a lot of vaccine and others didn't? So think about this as our conversation begins, whether the United States should have been more generous with vaccine stocks in the beginning. Should we be sharing much more than we're sharing right now? What do you want to know about how some countries got a lot of vaccine and others didn't? Tom Boyke is with us, director of the Global Health Program and senior fellow for Global Health Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations, with us from Washington, D.C. Tom Boyke, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
My great pleasure for being here.
Ashil Prabala is with us, health activist coordinator of the Access IBSA project, the campaigns for access to medicines in India and other countries at the Shuttleworth Foundation, and with us today from Bangalore, India. And Ashil Prabala, welcome. It's really good for you to take a moment and spend some time with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Will you tell me what your life is like day to day there?
I have to say that it has been a little surreal. And the reason it's been surreal is not because we're in a pandemic, I know that, but it's been such a seesaw over the last couple of days. We had, I would say, almost a near normal existence for about 4 months, starting last year, ending 2 weeks ago. It should have in reality ended much earlier than 2 weeks ago, and that could have saved us more than the lockdown now has. But I think the seesaw is assuming that life was back to normal, assuming that we had escaped the worst of the coronavirus pandemic last year, only to have a slow climb in cases suddenly grow into this absolute catastrophe that we see unfolding in India right now. I do have to say that I've worked on access to medicines now for 18 years. Mm-hmm. I have almost never been in a position where I'm the person that I'm fighting for, or my loved ones, or my family. One of my favorite people in the world, an owner of a bookshop who used to let me read books for free when I was a child, and mm-hmm. who I went to probably every single day of my life for about 25 years, died today of COVID, and he was only in his 70s. And it was absolutely heartbreaking. I have a cousin who died a couple of months ago who was 34 and asthmatic. It was still a shock. It is quite unbelievable. It's really like being in the middle of a very, very sad movie, which I have no control over whatsoever.
Oh my gosh, I am so sorry that you are losing friends and relatives, and it sounds like that is the experience of so many people in India. I have a question about the exporting of vaccines and the percentage of Indians themselves who are vaccinated. I've been reading reporting that says that in March, 40 million people had been vaccinated in India, which is just a small, small fraction of the population. 60 million doses were being exported. Is that right?
Not in March, but earlier than that, there were in the region of about 60 million doses exported in total. The way this is a complicated problem, and I think that the best way to explain it is that many years ago, Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, the international charity, called India the pharmacy of the developing world. And what they meant is that we have a good pharmaceutical industry here that can produce drugs and vaccines. And in many cases, those drugs and vaccines are not used merely for this country, but for other poor countries in the South Pacific, in sub-Saharan Africa, in other parts of Asia, and some parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. We've been doing this for many decades. In the coronavirus pandemic, however, what happened is that it intensified. Vaccines are obviously made by fewer people than even the number of companies across the world who can make generic pharmaceuticals, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of catastrophic bad planning, in my opinion, on the part of the vaccine overlords of poor countries, which is a group of organizations that form something called COVAX. And these organizations are the World Health Organization, Gavi, the Vaccines Alliance, and a very awkwardly named organization called the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. They underestimated many things in this pandemic, but what they underestimated the most was the kind of supply that they would get of vaccines and the number of places they would get that supply from. To cut a long story short, what happened by February and March is that it became clear to the world that in the short run, 92 poor countries in the world, or about half the world's population, would depend on a single company in a single country, India, for a single vaccine candidate.
Wow.
And so we were exporting those vaccines through the COVAX facility to those countries like Ghana and Nigeria who depended on us. But the moment the Indian resurgence became a reality, it also became very clear to our Indian government, who has to be accused of extreme incompetence in this, they realized very late, suddenly realized what the population of this country was, or seemingly. And when they did, they stopped vaccine exports, and we have essentially usurped vaccines that belong to half the world to supply ourselves to do something to increase our vaccination rates and cut the cords of this horrific resurgence.
And Tom, of course, to say that now we see the crisis that India is in, but these other countries are waiting for these vaccine doses as well. And it sounds like they're not going to get them.
That's right. It is tragic to watch. And first of all, it's horrible to watch what's happening in India now. And it's particularly sad because this was predictable. In every past global health crisis where there's been limited supplies of a medical intervention that would make a difference, wealthy nations have hoarded. And it has unfortunately happened in this instance as well. It is true. Everything that my colleague here on the phone has said is true. Ultimately, there have been 5 vaccines licensed to Indian manufacturers, $300 million provided to scale up manufacturing for the Serum Institute, the world's largest contract manufacturer. And unfortunately, because of bad planning, both internationally and domestically, those doses are not going to leave the country at this point. Wow. And it's not clear where else vaccine supplies will come from to meet most of the world's needs. We've so far distributed and administered globally 1.2 billion vaccine doses, but just 9 countries represent 3 out of every 4 of those vaccine doses administered.
Wow.
So the inequity is just is quite stark.
Boy, you are really putting it into perspective, both of you. Let me take some calls here to Peter in St. Paul. Hi, Peter. I really appreciate you waiting. What are you thinking about?
So I think what I was coming to is when I look at least Brazil, India, and Russia, the things that I've read mostly about their leadership is that they're sort of Trump lookalikes and they're very autocratic, and they've been saying that the disease wasn't real or it's been under control or whatever. And, you know, would they have your questions, Kerry, where would they, you know, should we have gotten them vaccines sooner?
Mm-hmm.
And should we send them more now? But I feel like, would they have taken them? Because it would have gone very strongly against what their positions were as leaders.
That's a good question.
And I look at our country and I say probably the main reason we're doing okay is because we started to recognize science after we got a new administration and we kicked more in gear and did those things. But it seems to me like those countries' leaders were denying COVID for a very long time, and now the public is suffering for that. So I think the answer to the question is now, if we can, and you know, your guests have good points of view on what is or isn't possible, but earlier I don't think they would have taken them.
Yeah, interesting observation. Tom, do you think that's right? It sounds, when I look at Brazil, what's happening there and what their leader has been saying about this, I think that's right on target. What would you say?
There's no question that poor governance has played a significant role in this pandemic, where, you know, after a certain point in January, every nation in the world faced a similar set of choices, and many nations failed to act promptly. That's certainly true for the United States, and it's been true in other countries as well, including India and Brazil, in my view. That said, there's no question that countries that still have done disastrously in this pandemic, when they've had adequate vaccine supplies, have still managed to use in a way that has suppressed spread of the virus. And at the end of the day, it is in every nation's interest that we get this pandemic under control. That's particularly true with the emergence of new dangerous variants. It's unfortunate what has happened in Brazil and other nations, but ultimately, if it leads to more rapid spread of this pandemic and more dangerous variants of this disease coming back to the United States, we don't have the luxury of standing in that judgment of others.
Tom Boyke is with us, if you've just joined the conversation, from the Global Health, Economics, and Development Committee at the Council on Foreign Relations. Aushil Prabala is a health activist and coordinator for the Access IBSA project. They campaign for access to medicines in India, Brazil, and South Africa at the Shuttleworth Foundation. Our conversation, of course, taking note of what's happening in India. It is all-out crisis there with the transmission of the virus and variants that appear to be more contagious. And we are getting some insight on why India, that is a global pharmaceutical manufacturer, is in a situation where it simply cannot ramp up to vaccinate quickly enough to get ahead of the vaccine. I'm asking you this morning, as you think about this, should the United States and other Western countries like the UK and some parts of Europe have been more generous with the vaccine stocks in the beginning? Should we have been sharing earlier on? What do you want to know about why some countries got a lot of vaccine and others didn't? To Rob in Painesville. Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for calling.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I'm a teacher. I am still a teacher. We were teaching in New Delhi, India, and we just got home Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
And it was bad. And it came out of nowhere. It felt like we had beat this. People weren't wearing masks anymore. People felt like coronavirus was done. And then all of a sudden, after spring break, friends went down to Goa. We traveled around a little bit to the Taj Mahal. And all of a sudden, people were getting sick. We had staff members sick. We had secretary sick, our head janitors died. I mean, and it just, my message is for fellow Americans is that this thing can maybe come roaring back, these new mutations, and please get vaccinated. It was awful. And we're so lucky that we got out and we're back here home in Minnesota. And we count our lucky stars that we got home.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have the insight of your experience. Ashok Prabhula, do you think that there is, given what you've just described about how this one vaccine manufacturer is trying to manufacture vaccines for so many countries, has India, other than taking, donations of doses from the United States and others, is India figuring out another solution for this?
This is a good question, Kerry, and it's an important one. And so the first thing I think it hints to is the question that you set out with, to say that you were asking listeners, I think, to consider whether the U.S. and other rich countries should be giving away more of their stock of vaccines.
Right.
So I think that's the wrong question, actually,
in
the sense just that I think it's a good impulse. The United States just donated 60 million doses of its stockpile of AstraZeneca vaccines, which were unlikely to be used in the United States. And when I say donated, they will be given away at an unspecified time in the future to an unspecified set of countries. So they're actually not coming to India next week, necessarily. Now, the reason I think that that's not the solution is that vaccines are a very scarce commodity right now, even for the United States, and especially for countries like Canada or places like the European Union, where they've received such fewer supplies of vaccines than places like the United States and the United Kingdom, which have done much better. So even if you're a rich country, there is a queue, and there are places in the West that are at the back of that queue. So it's not like, and I also feel, I think, empathy for the fact that in the United States, there is vaccine inequity. It's hard to reach Black and Hispanic citizens and residents when you compare the vaccination rates. White Americans certainly are vaccinated at faster rates. Hard to reach rural Americans with a vaccine. And so there are problems everywhere, right? And in this kind of a situation, I think to say, look, I want one of your vaccines so that one of us gets vaccinated instead of you is a difficult proposition to make.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the solution, which lay hiding in plain sight last year when your former president signed a bulk of the vaccine contracts and funneled a bulk of your money, essentially, to vaccine companies, there was a solution hiding in plain sight even then that he missed. And unfortunately, the U.S. administration and President Biden continues to miss to this day, which is this. You don't have to share vaccine doses. What you have to do is to create the opportunity for other vaccine manufacturers elsewhere in India, but honestly, everywhere else, Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, Ghana. Ghana has just petitioned AstraZeneca to allow vaccine manufacturers in Ghana to create the capacity to make the AstraZeneca vaccine. So all the United States needed to do was to say, we're funneling billions to you in research and development grants, in pre-orders for vaccines. And we want you to share your technology, share your intellectual property with manufacturers from elsewhere in the world. Let them take care of themselves, right? When the United States is in a position to donate vaccines, we will. When the United States feels economically secure enough, maybe to send overseas aid to ramp up vaccine infrastructure, we can. But right now, we have a magical thing that we can share with the world that could get people vaccinated. They did not. They continue to do not do it. And that is really the heart of the problem. There just aren't enough viable vaccine technologies to produce among the 24 registered vaccine manufacturers in this country, but also actually in vaccine manufacturing capacity in the West or in other poor countries.
So this is really eye-opening. So, Tom, if you agree with what Ashok is suggesting, this would be the United States saying to Moderna or Pfizer, send the technology over to these manufacturers in other places and let them ramp up using your vaccine formula? Is that it?
So I think a couple of things. One is that the one issue on which I might differ a little bit from from my colleague is I actually think donations do have an important role to play.
Okay.
Ultimately, the EU expects to have vaccinated more than 70% of the eligible population by July. The U.S. expects to reach that same threshold around the same time frame. The same is true for the U.K. They have hundreds of millions of doses that will still be available at that time, mm-hmm. available sooner, and those doses should go to where they're most needed. Ultimately, even if we expand the indication to 12 and 15-year-olds, there are only 10 million of those in the United States, ultimately. You can still see we will be producing more vaccine than that. The fact that the world's needs exceed hundreds of millions of doses, which they do, isn't a reason not to start donating doses now.
Okay, so
the solution at this point that is most likely to result in more doses happening globally. The part where I do agree with my colleague is that there's no question we need more global manufacturing of vaccines. We need that because particularly with the emergence of variants, we'll need to make a lot more vaccine even than we would initially in this pandemic, and that we may need booster shots. It may be because if there are variants that spread more easily, we need to vaccinate more people. We're going to need a lot more supply. And there's no question that is going to result in scaling. That's going to require scaling out manufacturing. The only caution I would hear on the, it's not just a matter of licensing IP. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, four were licensed in India to multiple manufacturers, not just the Serum Institute. And $300 million was provided to scale up manufacturing also in India. We certainly need more capacity, but it's not just going to be a matter of licensing IP. We also need financing, the policy support, the kinds of things that ramped up manufacturing in the United States and other countries that have greatly increased vaccine. We need to see that globally.
Okay. Let me take another call here from Josiah in Brooklyn Park. Hi, Josiah. Questions that are coming up for you.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was wondering, I agree that the doses or the vaccines rather should be shared, and as with the intellectual property, so that more people can make the vaccines. But what I'm wondering is, since we're currently in a situation where companies want to keep their intellectual property and not share it for greed and other reasons, is it in fact better to have or to try and fully vaccinate the United States and the UK in order to keep those countries okay and isolated, maybe like New Zealand, perhaps, mm-hmm. as opposed to spreading them evenly and kind of resulting in everyone still being in crisis mode, perhaps not to the extent that India is, but
got it.
Would the variants continue to happen even if we did spread all of that?
Tom, how would you answer that?
Yeah, so one thing I will say is we are not likely to reach herd immunity in the United States against this virus for a couple of reasons. The first is that current estimates are between 25 to 30% of adults are not likely to get vaccinated in this country because of hesitancy. The United States has historically been terrible at vaccinating adults. In the average year, fewer than 50% of American adults get vaccinated for the flu shot. And among high-risk communities, Black and Latinx populations in the United States as well, the rates are actually even lower. So it will also be some time before we vaccinate children. So all this is to say this variant issue is going to be happening in the United States. I mean, it's going to be happening at the same time globally. We're not likely to reach herd immunity. There's no fortress that's going to protect us. New Zealand's situation may be different because they've really managed to stop the spread of the virus into the country,
although that's not going to continue indefinitely, but they have an opportunity that we don't in terms of being able to vaccinate ahead of this population. But we really need to look at this vaccination campaign in this country as about protecting the most vulnerable and high-risk populations. And at some point, as we start to become, instead of supply constrained, demand constrained, which is happening now, where we have far more supply starting to happen now, where we have far more supply than there are Americans willing to take these shots, we need to start thinking about higher risk populations abroad, because at some point when you have very low risk populations in the United States, we may actually be benefiting Americans more by stopping transmission and protecting the collapse of health systems like in India than we are vaccinating very low-risk members of our own population.
Conversation this morning about what the fact of vaccine monopolies has meant in countries around the world. United States is going to share some of our vaccine stock, should we have done it earlier. And one of the things I want to get to with our guests on the other side of news is whether the skepticism that was pretty widespread about China and Russia's vaccine, that Sputnik V Russia vaccine, whether skepticism about that should drop and there should be more acceptance of the idea that China and Russia have a valuable vaccine and they should be sharing that with the countries in need. Ashil Prabhula, I wanted to ask you about something that you've been writing about, which essentially argues that Western countries should drop the skepticism about Sputnik and the Russian vaccine and the vaccine that China has created and embrace it as more of an international solution. What has that skepticism meant, do you think, up till now?
You know, what I think it's meant, Kerry, is that that Americans or Europeans or Canadians or anyone in need of different vaccine choices has sometimes, I think, been kept away from what could be a possibly excellent and useful vaccine. Now, there are some European countries that have stepped out, like Hungary and Serbia, and have done their own deals with Chinese and Russian vaccine manufacturers. There are rumblings constantly within Germany that they want to do the same thing, but they're bound by European medical regulation, which is processing an application from Sputnik V for approval. My larger point, however, the geopolitics aside and the kinds of feelings that geopolitics often create in citizens of states that have adversarial relations with other states, is that good science can happen outside the West. I'm from India. I grew up in towards the end of the Cold War, and we had lots of contact with Soviet scientists and people from this country and other poor countries who spent a lot of energy studying science. And I know that there are good scientists here, and we have a capacity to produce medical innovation. We have vaccines in this world, in this pandemic, coming out not just from Russia and China, but we have an indigenous vaccine from India called Covaxin, which is actually in use in the country. It's been approved. We have a vaccine from Cuba that's being co-produced in Iran. Huh. We have actually about three or four vaccine projects in Cuba, but we have two that are at a fairly late stage, at the end of starting their phase three trials to determine if efficacy. We have more nascent vaccine projects in countries as disparate as Vietnam and Thailand and a range of other places. So the point here is actually that there is the ability that's fairly widespread to produce these vaccines. And some countries have the further ability to take those projects into commercial production and mass manufacturing and actually put them out. Now, all of them deserve a fair chance at assessment. And the way that this is typically done is country by country. So India has just evaluated actually and approved the Sputnik V vaccine for use. It took a long time to do. So it was a careful evaluation. At the same time, Brazil looked at that same application. Well, actually a different application. Brazil looked at data from Russia. India looked at data that was created in India, where we ran our own clinical trials for Sputnik. But Brazil actually has rejected the Sputnik vaccine. Huh. Now, that's, I think, the way things should work, is that you have vaccines that can go out into the world, and each country, depending on its capacity to assess these these vaccines should do that, right? And that's what's been happening. At the international level, however, at the WHO, which has sort of an international regulatory system, which sort of, certifies vaccines for the world. At the WHO has a very funny process where if your vaccine is approved in Europe or the United States, you're fast-tracked through the system. So they approved the Pfizer vaccine just 10 days after Europe had approved it. But Sputnik V, which started conversations with them way back in August, is still going to be waiting in line, and it's in fact going to take 2 or 3 months more. So the assessment system for these vaccines is skewed, and I think that could be fixed, because they then provide a better opportunity to vaccinate the world, which we all agree is what needs to happen now.
You may, as a listener, if you're just joining the discussion, you may have a view on whether the United States should have been more generous with its vaccines and vaccine technology early on, because there are many, many countries in the world that do not have the supply that they need. What do you want to know about how some countries got a lot of vaccine and others didn't? 651-227-6000 to Terry in St. Paul. Hi, Terry. What are you thinking about? Good morning.
I think the United States should figure out the cost of each dose, and with our excess supply, because clearly now we're going to have excess supply, sell that to rich countries, but for every at double the cost, and for every vaccine a rich country buys, like Japan, Australia, Canada, etc., give away one to a country that cannot and will not get a vaccine very soon.
Hmm. Tom, what do you think of that idea?
So let me make sure I understand the listener's question. So the idea is to sell the doses now to wealthy countries that may be willing to purchase it and then use those resources to manufacture more for poor countries. Is that right?
Terry, is that pretty much what you're saying? I think it is.
No.
Oh.
Well, not really. I mean, not just sell what we have right now, but for every dose that is sold now, weigh one now, too.
Okay. What do you think, Tom?
So I think that the main objective here for the doses is saving lives. So I'm in favor of anything that provides more doses that can get to the countries most in need fastest. I will say most wealthy countries have procured enough doses. It's a matter of when they start being supplied, but they procured them. They purchased them. It's really poor nations that are lacking supplies, and there's some urgency in getting to them. So I would be a little bit concerned by anything that slows the process down of getting those doses to the countries where you're seeing a surge in the virus. And it's not just in India. You're seeing it in Latin America as well.
Right.
But very much in favor in creative ways of trying to increase supplies. So I like the impulse. I just want it to go as quickly as it can.
Nick says on Twitter, what's happening in India now can happen anywhere. I don't think we should be holding on to these extra doses, especially since we seem to be at the point in America where we are now dragging along the hesitant to get their shots. Aman says, with vaccine monopoly, we need to take a long-term view, i.e. the next inevitable pandemic. If a patent waiver is forced, it might dissuade pharma companies from developing vaccines in the future. He adds, tough. I want to hear from both of you on that. Is that the concern given the way the vaccine manufacturers have stepped up with development, do we worry that if you force them to share, Tom, they might be more reluctant to do that in the future?
I do think we have to worry about the incentives for companies in the future. I think there are a variety of ways to deal with that, though. And I think it's important to remember patents and intellectual property are a tool. And if they're a benefit given by the government in exchange for innovations meant to meet the social welfare, and if that system isn't working, then there are other options that can be pursued to have that benefit. My concern mostly on the waiver side is that it's at best, a piece of a larger puzzle that needs to happen to scale out global manufacturing. And I fear that a fight over a waiver is going to bog down the process of scaling out global manufacturing with all the incentives and the support. Again, licensing lots of vaccines to Indian manufacturers wasn't the solution alone to scaling up supply in that country. We need to see the same kind of support that we scaled up manufacturing in this country and others that have vaccines in a pandemic, the financing, the policy, the standing up, the supporting inputs and raw materials you need to manufacture vaccine. We can do that globally. We have done that on HIV. We're just not. And I worry that we are wasting an awful lot of time to get to that point where we start to mobilize that kind of global effort. And we need to see it out of wealthy nations.
What do you think about that, Asha Prabhula? And then we'll talk about what the lessons, both good and bad, that we're learning for the next pandemic. But specifically to Aman's note here about discouraging maybe the manufacturers to step into this arena again.
So I'm not an academic, so I'm going to just talk straight.
Yeah. Okay.
Firstly, I think when we talk about things like the next pandemic and what will happen next, I just want everybody to focus on the fact that this pandemic is taking a toll of 2.5 million lives a year, is set to actually take a higher toll on lives this year if vaccinations don't speed up, and is causing economic losses to the world of between $2 and $8 trillion, according to the International Chambers of Commerce, which are not, you know, your traditional leftist marchers.
Right.
So the fact is that, you know, when we say things about yes, you know, it may do things in this pandemic, but the next one will be tough. I'm just thinking, but you know, you're saying, yes, it'll solve 2.5 million people not dying and possibly $8 trillion not being lost, which is quite a bit, right? I mean, so in one way, I think whatever the costs of this are, whatever the consequences of this are, the solutions to the extent that they work in this pandemic do need to be applied and thought about. But to the question of what will we do for the next pandemic, the answer, I think, is that we'll do what we did in this pandemic, which was shovel a very large sums of money to the manufacturers to make these vaccines, like giving Moderna $1 billion, which covered 100% of their research costs, which meant they didn't have to risk any money,
right?
Which means that essentially if somebody is just writing you a blank check for all the risk that you would otherwise have taken with private capital, right? Doing the same exactly to nearly the same extent with Johnson & Johnson, and then to a slightly lesser extent to AstraZeneca and to Novavax, right? But then further buttressing them by providing them very substantial pre-orders at profit-making prices, because all of these companies have now reported their sales and profits, and they've made profits, right? So there are so many ways in which we could do it again, and the most clear way is just by doing it the way we did now, regardless of what the laws are, by spending a lot of money to fix the problem and fixing it.
But wait a minute. So as you say, this is probably the model, the government stepping in with a lot of money to absorb the risk for these vaccine developers, but to also intervene early enough so that there, I think you're arguing, that there are not vaccine monopolies in the making, right?
Absolutely. Look, the way in which these things are normally done when you set up prize funds or you commission research, you know, it's very strange that you commission something and then you have no rights on it, right? I mean, if you were building a house and, you know, you commissioned an article and, but, you know, you had to pay somebody every time you looked at it, that would be a bit tough, right? But that is the situation roughly with the vaccines that the U.S. government commissioned. And I think what's happening there is that on your behalf, as an American taxpayer, it's being denied, like the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are unlikely to get to me this year or the next. And that's being done on your behalf, right? With your tax dollars. So I'm just saying that's not a choice I think you made. And so I think the U.S. government, if it were to act on, you know, on what people's choices really are, and to understand that it's to give the technology to the world for other people to develop, not Pfizer, because it's an inappropriate vaccine. It needs to be stored at temperatures that cannot be in many poor countries. But the Moderna technology is excellently replicable in poor countries. And so if that could be done in a way that does not at all compromise the American effort to be vaccinated, the American economic recovery. Now, wouldn't that be a wonderful solution? It exists. It's just not been implemented.
Call here from Mary in Duluth. Hi, Mary. What'd you want to add?
Hi, I just wanted to say that you brought up vaccine hesitant people.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot of research, talking with a lot of people. And here's just a little I know related to the concerns about distributing the vaccinations. I think a lot of people are seeing a certain level of colonialism operated from the U.S. We look at these multi-billion companies, Pfizer's on score to make up to $59 and $61 billion, up to $42 billion. They're not sharing their patent. And I also look at things with vaccination safety for those. When you look at the Vayers and you look at those actually where they have had some physical injuries or consequences to the vaccination, there isn't much in compensation for them, in spite of these companies making lots of money.
Mary, I think I have the essence of what you're saying. Tom, when you look at the model of, again, you know, countries like the United States stepping in to absorb all of the risk and then the value rising, with these companies, do you see that? I mean, do you think that that's pretty much a model that we can look back and say that worked, and there probably won't be a lot of encouragement for, again, the sharing the way Aushal is talking about of the technology?
Yeah, so I'll say a few things. First, I do think it's important to recognize the U.S. did a lot more than just promise a bunch of money to these manufacturers. Ultimately, they basically constructed supply chains around them. They matched manufacturers at different stages of the process with other manufacturers, in some cases internationally. They mobilized all the production of vials and raw materials and single-use components to stand all this up. I say this because, again, it's ultimately not going to just be about money. Wealthy nations have offered, and in some cases have donated money to the international multilateral effort. What they haven't seen is a stand-up of this kind of initiative to do all the other things you need to do to scale production in a crisis, and we need it desperately. So there's that to be said. There have been Western countries that did license their vaccines, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, Novavax. We're really talking about the countries that have been reluctant or companies to reluctant to license their vaccines. We're really talking about Moderna and Pfizer in particular, which have licensed within Europe and the United States, but not internationally. And that's really the issue, these mRNA vaccines, where we can see a scale out of that process and what needs to be done to facilitate more technology transfer of that, because that is a technology that's going to be really important in this crisis, but also in future pandemics as well.
So, Aushal, I wondered about that, whether the vaccines that are available to India, and you told us about some of the other vaccines that are being developed around the world. Are they this mRNA technology, or is that pretty unique to Pfizer and Moderna?
It's absolutely unique to Pfizer and Moderna. It's also absolutely unique to the world. It's the first time that mRNA technology, which has existed for a while, has proven to be useful and applicable. So it's a genuine medical breakthrough, and I salute the scientists who developed it. Many of them, of course, by the way, again, paid for by your tax dollars at the National Institutes of Health, like Dr. Barney Graham, who invented a range of different useful parts that go into the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, right? So many of the things that are integral to the way they work, including the basic mRNA technology itself, was actually developed by the US government. The interesting thing about mRNA is not only the fact that these vaccines work excellently, so there's an immediate need for it. The platform, if it works for other things like an HIV vaccine, where it's now showing some promise, or for cancer therapies, means that it could be something very important to us in the future. Right. So that's exciting. And then the last thing that's genuinely great about the platform is that vaccines, we have typically thought of them until mRNA came along as what we call biologics, the category of drugs they fall under, because they contain a virus or a protein, you know, something that's, you know, squiggles and lives, right? Whereas the mRNA vaccine is actually chemistry. It's a chemical process to produce that vaccine. And so what's interesting about it, potentially, and I say potentially because there are a couple of, you know, twists and turns in that process, it's potentially much easier to make and it's faster to make than a traditional vaccine.
Call here from Katie in Crystal. Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for waiting. What did you want to add?
Hi. Yeah, so I know we were talking a bit about just the potential of these vaccine creators withholding them if we potentially force them to share their intellectual property. And I guess, like, my perception on it, I'm a social worker, I work in the medical field, and I think that that concern kind of speaks just to larger issues with just prescription and systemic issues in general with big pharma. And that considering with this pandemic, that we just countries in general have put a lot of money into the creation of these vaccines and that urgency that went into that, that especially here in the U.S., the systemic issues that go into like in medication, for instance.
Oh, it's such a... Katie, yeah. Forgive me for interrupting. We've only got a couple minutes left,
it's
but
totally fine.
It's
yeah.
such a great observation because, you know, we have a real love-hate relationship with pharmaceutical companies. I mean, they're bailing us out. Thank God they've intervened and are bailing us out of a crisis like this. But Tom, it's also undeniable that that pharmaceutical companies, I guess, have been known to take advantage of and, you know, step in when they see opportunity and charge a lot of money for needed drugs. I wonder, just in observing what has happened in the last year, whether you think that relationship, the complexity of it only deepens, or we might see these pharmaceutical companies in a different way.
Yeah, I think the complexity will deepen ultimately. And I agree with you. I think the companies deserve some real credit for how quickly these vaccines have been developed. The previous record for a novel vaccine was 4 years. These vaccines were developed in 10 months.
Yeah.
Truly remarkable how well. And they're not just developed fast. They are among the world's most effective vaccines. You know, particularly the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, you're talking about effectiveness at 95% plus. In some cases, the results show more effective for older populations. A really good safety profile, remarkable vaccines delivered very quickly. But we have a system in general where we incentivize the development of drugs based on an ability to charge a high price
right
after they've been developed. And that trades off innovation for access.
That's
and
where...
unfortunately, in crises like this where you have global need, that tension really comes to bear.
Tom Boyke with us from the Council on Foreign Relations. Asha Prabhula with us from Access IBSA. Thank you both for a really insightful conversation and good calls and questions, too.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.